Hello and welcome to Late Night Live. Norman Swan here, sitting in for Philip Adams. Tonight, the Hamas-Fatah unity government. Is it a match made in hell? And a gift for Benjamin Netanyahu, who seems to have no intention of negotiating a peace settlement. A Palestinian analyst later, who in fact believes the best strategy to move forward is to ditch the US as a mediator and get the European Union involved. But is the EU such a basket case economically and so inwardly focused politically after the recent elections that it hasn't the capacity to take the lead in international diplomacy? We'll look under the EU's economic and political bonnet as well. That's after we redress the political balance here on LNL and talk about what one commentator says is the Abbott government's record of unbroken promises. But according to Mike Seckham, the Saturday paper's political correspondent, the promises aren't so much to the Australian public as to the Institute of Public Affairs, the IPA. It's a Melbourne-based think tank funded at least in part by the tobacco industry, which has grown over many years to considerable political influence. The Western Australia Treasurer, Mike Mahan, for example, is a former boss of the IPA. Christian Kerr is a political columnist for The Australian and also writes for the IPA magazine and is an old LNL hand. Welcome back, Christian.
Norman.
And Mike Seckham is with us too. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Norman.
Mike, what were the unbroken promises that you were talking about?
My point was essentially that after the election there was a lot of talk about how many promises the government had broken, and so I went back to Tony Abbott's appearance at the 70th anniversary of the foundation of the IPA, where he stood up in front of an audience including Rupert Murdoch and Gina Rinehart, and made a whole bunch of commitments, none of which have been broken. In fact, he's possibly under-promised and over-delivered. The IPA had a wish list, what they called a list of 75 radical ideas that they would like to see the Abbott government implement. And so I just went through and compared that list with some of the things the government been doing.
For example?
Well, can I read you a little bit of Abbott's speech? What he said was, "I want to assure you the coalition will indeed repeal the carbon tax, abolish the Department of Climate Change, abolish the Clean Energy Fund. We will repeal Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, at least in its current form. We will abolish new health and environmental bureaucracies. We will deliver $1 billion in red tape savings every year. We will develop Northern Australia. We will repeal the mining tax. We will create a one-stop shop for environmental approvals. We will privatise Medibank Private. We will trim the public service, and we will stop throwing good money after bad on the NBN." So, ladies and gentlemen, he finished up, "That is a big yes." And he was referring, I might add, specifically to the wish list of things that the IPA wanted.
Christian Kerr, do you accept that analysis that the implication by Mike is that the IPA is the puppet master pulling the strings?
Well, actually, Mike seems to have forgotten that the IPA then actually topped up that list of 75 radical ideas. They decided to go for the full ton, went up to 100 of them. Now, Mike's ticked off 12 on the list, 12 out of 100. I think that's a rather severe case of under-delivering. And these
so
are
what,
just
what
cool
else,
parts,
what else
these
do they
just
want?
Cool parts of Tony Abbott's policy.
In fact, I did go on to the rest of the list, and that's why I said Abbott under-promised and over-delivered, because other major items on the IPA wish list were stopping subsidies for the car industry, which has been done, eliminating family tax benefits, which has been partly done, ceasing funding for the ABC's Australia Network, which has been done, abandonment of poker machine reforms, which has been done, introduction of fee competition for Australian universities, which has been done, negotiating free trade deals with Japan, South Korea, China and India, which is more than half done. And there were a bunch of others, which I won't go into for the sake of time, but, the big food and tobacco and alcohol lobbies were sort of thrown the carcass, as Peter Martin put it in a wonderful analysis piece in The Age, thrown the carcass of the Australian National Preventative Health Agency. So there's quite a lot of them, and I'm not suggesting, in fact, that the IPA is the puppet master of the Abbott government, but I am suggesting that it and a couple of other fairly small right-wing think tanks do serve as a sort of outsourced policy formulation outfit for the government, and they do, in part by the weight of some of the people who are members, i.e. Murdoch and Rinehart and some other big corporates, they do have an awful lot of clout within the government.
Christian?
Well, I think this is just what think tanks do. I mean, if you look in the UK, for example, where I actually think probably we have the most vibrant think tank environment, you're not a serious contender for leadership unless you've got a think tank behind you. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was closely affiliated with the Institute of Economic Affairs. Demos, under Tom Bentley, who went along to work for Julia Gillard and is still active here in Australia. Demos provided a whole lot of the philosophical underpinning for the Blair years. I mean, what think tanks are, is they're effectively just institutionalised ginger groups, so naturally they're going to be feeding into the political process. I mean, we've got a whole marketplace of ideas out there, and that's what think tanks do. They're effectively fulfilling different needs in that marketplace. But just because you have this marketplace, it doesn't mean you go in and take every idea off the shelf. And that just seems to be the proposition here, that every idea that the IPA comes up with just seems to be adopted holus bolus by the government. There's a whole lot in the background that they wouldn't touch at all. I mean, the IPA has had some, you know, I've actually had cabinet ministers, you know, absolutely denigrate these ideas. Ideas on asylum seekers, ideas on things like the security state, data retention, NSA surveillance, marriage equality, a whole lot of ideas like that also there, which would just be dropped by almost anyone to do with the Abbott government.
Well, I would suggest that you've in fact only enumerated two ideas, because the security state, the NSA and data retention are all sort of parts of the one thing. And it is true, here as in America, the far left and the far right have something of a unity ticket on the whole idea of surveillance. Because of very strong views on the rights of the individual and that the government shouldn't be interfering in the rights of the individual. But I don't think that anyway undermines my argument, which is simply that this is a very influential group of people. And I would suggest also that what makes this a little different from other think tanks is that a lot of think tanks are there to carry out, you know, research and come up with ideas based on evidence. The IPA, I would suggest, has more in common with some of those American so-called think tanks, you know, the Heartland Institute and things like that, which are actually propagandizing on behalf of certain vested interests and ideas.
I suppose, Christian, that is the crux of it, is that the IPA lacks transparency. It took a while to dig out the fact that it receives, or has in the past received, significant money from the tobacco industry. It seems to receive money from the oil industry. And it would just help to understand where it was truly coming from. Is the lack of transparency is, I think, part of the argument here.
Well, look, I just jumped on the websites of the Whitlam Institute and the McKell Institute this evening. I couldn't find anything about
their finances.
You mean
you're not paying attention to this conversation, Christian?
I jumped onto the Australia Institute website. I got their net profit. I also jumped onto the IPA website and got, I think, a 12-page financial statement. The IPA's argument is that donors or suspected donors in the past have been targeted by groups and therefore they don't disclose them. I mean, there was literally this risible situation in the dying days of the Howard government when I think it was Kelvin Thompson, as a Labor shadow minister, writing to energy companies he thought were funding the IPA and telling them they mustn't. I mean, that's a pretty ridiculous state of affairs in a pluralist liberal democracy.
But they have had trouble with some of those policies that you were talking about that people ran away from. They were too socially conservative for some of their donors.
Oh, well, I mean, that's the risk they take. As I said, it's a marketplace of ideas. You know, you throw your bread on the water.
Well, yes, but fewer and fewer people are taking the bread as it is thrown on the water. And that's a very good point.
No, you can't have it both ways, Mike. You've just said fewer and fewer people are taking the bread. And they're the secret power behind the government.
No, I didn't say they were the secret power behind the government at all. I said that they were influential and that they tried out a lot of ideas on the government's behalf and they propagandized on the government's behalf. I'm not trying to overstate their importance either. But it is certainly true that in the past...
Well, hold on a second, Mike. You're receding from your article now.
No. I'm not receding from my article at all. I'm saying that they're a tremendously powerful body. But equally, I think that Christian is for purposes of his own, rather exaggerating my argument too, which is, you know, that they are the puppet masters pulling the strings of the government. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that they float ideas and that they put a lot of ideas to the government. A lot get accepted. Some get rejected. That's true. But if I may return to the point of bread on the waters, it's certainly the case that some of their past ideas, for example, when they were very hardline on Aboriginal land rights and Aboriginal issues generally about a decade ago, a lot of their large corporate donors started dropping off very quickly. Some of the big banks dropped off, a couple of the mining companies dropped off because they were concerned that it was just too extreme. And when I spoke to John Roscombe, the boss of the IPA, he acknowledged that, in fact, they were less dependent these days on large corporate donors, with a few exceptions, and more on what you might call sort of middle-tier, small, medium sort of businesses and people in those areas who had, you know, fairly strong right-wing market-oriented views. So I don't think I'm undermining the argument. I'm just saying that the IPA's source of funding has changed a bit, but they remain terribly influential.
So let's look at the political implications of think tanks for a moment then, Christian Kerr and Mike Seckham. Christian, from the polls, it could be argued that the community has rejected the current direction of the government in the terms of perhaps something loosely called fairness, and that by being so committed to one line of thinking in this outsourced environment, they might be being led up a political dead end.
Well, I actually think they've, let's switch the metaphor, I think they've managed to tie themselves in knots, absolutely.
You know, the dead end, yeah.
If I'm going to put on my spin doctor's hat, this has been a dismally sold budget. The framing of the budget was terrible. The framing of the Commission of Audit report was terrible. The lumping together of the two was terrible. Joe Hockey's budget speech was absolutely bloody awful, as far as I'm concerned. I think they're sort of two separate issues. We've had a government that sort of constructed a very successful narrative in opposition, and I hate using that term narrative, but the role of politicians is to tell stories, to explain what they're doing, why they're doing them, and where they hope to lead us with their decisions. I think the government has failed that test around this budget, and it's going to be really struggling in the water for a while until it actually manages to get a message that's coherent. I think that's separate from the policy. I think the policy that you come up with from think tanks, whatever colour they are, is, you know, to use an expression of Blair's when he charged one of his people to go out in opposition and rethink Social Security. He said their job was to think the unthinkable. And effectively, that's what think tanks are there to do. They're to push ideas. They're to experiment with ideas. And it's for the politicians to do with advice, be it from the public sector, be it from academia, be it from wherever, to weigh it up and to consider the practical implications from all points of view.
And my argument in response to that would be that the government has clearly swallowed rather too much of the IPA's ideas, and that the problem with the budget is partly selling. I agree, they've sold it extremely badly, but underneath that is a fundamental question of fairness, and it's not just the selling that has been the problem. The problem is that the burden of the adjustments the government is talking about making falls overwhelmingly on people further down the socioeconomic scale. And it seems the further down the scale you are, the harder it hits you, and the further up you are, the less problems you have. So the IPA agenda, to the extent that it's been adopted by the government, has been quite damaging.
So what you're arguing that it hasn't been moderated. Christian, what do you think is behind slightly changing direction, but it is somebody who has been allied in some shape or form to the IPA, it's Andrew Bolt, and sort of the Andrew Bolt, Alan Jones attack on Malcolm Turnbull and this whole leadership issue. Is this an IPA-inspired set of actions?
No, not at all. Look, I'd actually think that what might be going on here is that Malcolm Turnbull's a very convenient whipping boy if you want to have a go at the government, but you don't want to actually have a go at Tony Abbott or Joe Hockey directly. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull's an extremely high-profile member of the government. He's one of the most intellectually capable members of the government, and I think really if you want to rough them up, we'll rough up Turnbull.
Right. No, I can't agree with that. I think that the problem here is, I'm not suggesting for a minute that it's IPA-directed, but I think there's...
Oh, you're spoiling the conspiracy theory.
Well, no, but I am suggesting that there's a bit of a panic going on in the sort of right-wing commentariat at the moment. They don't like Turnbull for a start because he's an actual liberal. He's not a conservative. He's rational on things like climate change and same-sex marriage and things like that. And at the other end of the extreme, they have Clive Palmer, who's sort of out demagoguing them, for want of a better term. And suddenly the sort of marginal and inchoately angry people to whom people like Bolt and Jones appeal have a new favourite, which is Clive. So, you know, here we have Clive and Malcolm having dinner together. Well, wow, it was just guaranteed to set them off.
So it's confusion.
Well, it's confusion, and it's a matter of quick pass me a distraction. You know, they've been for a long time a conduit by which they can direct people's anger in a way that is beneficial to conservative politics. And at the moment, they're having a lot of trouble working out exactly how to do that.
So, if I were to sum up this conversation, and you two can comment, obviously, is that we are in a free marketplace of ideas, and there are a set of ideas coming out of the IPA, which they're most entitled to do, and the people who fund them are most entitled to fund them. However, the issue at the core is whichever party's in power, you would ask for political judgment to be exercised on the advice.
Absolutely. And I wish we'd got to it, but the other thing that I wanted to say about the IPA that makes them different from the average think tank is that they actually set up front organisations which are in no way related to policy development or anything else. They set up, you know, an ersatz environment organisation.
The Australian Environment Foundation.
Yes, that mimic the name of the ACF and which is in fact stacked with climate change deniers and gets its funding from right-wing groups in America. And they did a similar thing some time ago with tobacco, where they imported overseas alleged scientists to speak to the fact that tobacco wasn't really harmful. And they've done the same thing with independent contractors. So they set up these little front groups. And in the incoming Senate, we will have a couple of IPA alumni who are not actually in the Liberal Party, but are out even further to the right, in David Lanholm and Bob Day, one of whom was actually involved in some of these front groups. So the IPA is, like you said, it's a bit of a ginger group for the Liberal Party, but these days it's taking a bit of the Tea Party route, really. It's managing to get into Parliament people who are even further to the right than the right.
So, Christian, that sounds like a bit more than an outsourced think tank, outsourced thinking group.
As far as I'm aware, the Australian Environment Foundation has no involvement with the IPA. I don't know what the relationship between Independent Contractors Australia is.
Well, I can tell you about the
Bob Day from Family First has been heavily involved in the building industry. As he's a home builder, he was one of the people who went to war with the Keating government over interest rates 20 years ago. So he's been active in a whole lot of causes. David Lionholm, I think you'd have to say, is very much a standalone libertarian. I mean, Mike earlier was talking about inchoate anger. I mean, I really think that much of this talk about the IPA is, the inchoate anger from the chattering classes. It's an upmarket version of conspiracy theorizing. I mean, there's
we let you off late night live, Christian, and you just turned feral.
There is a silly bunch of people on the right who will go around and tell you all sorts of things about the Fabian Society. Now, I'd actually have rather liked sitting down reading the New Statesman magazine. I'm sorry, I don't believe that. And I think actually any sensible person who's interested in the clash of ideas would actually reject a lot of this argument as much the same as just upmarket conspiracy theorising.
Well, as to the conspiracy theory of the Australian Environment Foundation, I mean, it was formed essentially by the IPA. Jennifer Morohassy and Mike Nahan were both on the AEF board for its first 18 months of life. It shared an address. Its principal place of business was listed on its Australian Securities and Investment Commission records, which I accessed a year or so ago. I haven't had a look at them lately, as its place of business, Institute of Public Affairs, Level 2, 410 Collins Street, Melbourne, Victoria 3000. So it's not a conspiracy theory at all. It's reality. And it's something that is not really think tank sort of stuff. It's propagandist sort of stuff.
We're going to have to leave it there and you two can duke it out as time goes on.
We will at some future occasion, I'm sure.
Thank you very much to you both. Christian Kerr, political correspondent for The Australian and also writes for the IPA magazine and former correspondent for Late Night Live from Canberra. And but you know, you can come back anytime, Christian. Mike Secombe, political correspondent for The Saturday Paper. I'm Norman Swan. You're listening to Late Night Live. Coming up, the situation currently economically and politically in Europe.